Today is March the 31st. It is World Backup Day, and it is celebrated just one day before April Fool's Day. I'll have more to say about this in my feature segment. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Radio Shack, the once popular electronics chain, is rising from the ashes. Radio Shack went bankrupt in 2015 and again in 2017, and the physical stores, once Tinker's Paradise, at least for me, full of electronics components and computer gear, closed one by one, and a company called Retail E-Commerce Ventures, that's REV, bought the brand and most of the company's assets. Well, let's fast forward a few years, and once again, Radio Shack seems to be rising from the grave. REV is planning to turn the electronics store into an e-commerce site to rival Best Buy. REV CEO Alex Mirer made the following statement. The ultimate objective here is really not reviving the Radio Shack brand. It is to create a massive online shopping mall. Imagine the shopping malls that you and I grew up with. They had a lot of familiar brands, and the collective gravitational pulls brought people in. That's what we're creating. The goal then is to create a sort of e-commerce hub where you can visit REV's other brands like Pier 1 Imports and Dressbarn, and then stop into Radio Shack for the latest gadget being showcased. Mia noted that Best Buy is the seventh largest online e-commerce store in the United States with few competitors. The idea isn't awful. Retailers saw 36 massive bankruptcies in 2020 and 8,400 stores closed last year. Some, like New York's famous Century 21, went bankrupt, but are reorganizing with a focus on online sales. But many won't return, turning shopping centers and malls into ghost towns. By creating the physical shopping experience and capturing the consumer inside a virtual mall, REV could bring once more consuming consumers into a post-COVID reality. While it won't make the Radio Shack of what you knew come back, it does mean the old brand can get a facelift and hopefully regain some of its, well, former customers. Fry's Electronics now closed permanently. Best Buy's closing stores and has laid off 5,000 full-time workers. But Radio Shack once again crawls out of the grave. Anybody who can go down 3,000 feet in a mine can sure as hell learn to program as well. Biden told an audience in Derry, New Hampshire back in December 31st, 2019. Anybody who can throw coal into the furnace can learn how to program, for God's sake. Well, anyone can become a programmer. However, not everyone can become a good programmer or even a competent one to work in information technology. Even fewer can become an exceptional programmer. The National Science Board, that's the NSB of the United States, establishes the policies of the National Science Foundation, that's NSF, within the framework of applicable national policies set forth by the President and the Congress. The NSB also serves as an independent policy advisory board to the President and Congress on science and engineering research and education issues. The NSB recently released a biennial report. Science and Engineering Indicators provides comprehensive policy-neutral information on the nation's science and engineering enterprise. In addition to the main report, the NSB produces a suite of related resources. Science and Engineering Indicators in 2020, the State of U.S. Science and Engineering. This report breaks down by ethnic and race. Hispanic may be any race. American Indian or Alaska Native, Asian or Pacific Islander, Black or African American, and white refers to individuals who are not Hispanic origin. Percentages do not add to the total because data do not include individuals who did not report their race and ethnicity. Since 1971, about one-third of all freshmen planned to enter science and engineering. This proportion gradually rose to 45% by 2016. Of that 45%, 6% are in mathematics, statistics, or computer sciences, which means less than 3% of entering freshmen are in math, statistics, and computer sciences study. Computer sciences covers a very wide swath of technology. The NSB study revealed that computer sciences is a subject which suffers from the highest dropout rate at 9.8%, of which a third of them said it was too hard. Can anyone be a computer programmer? Sure, the answer is yes. But can everyone be a computer programmer? The answer is no. The fact is, the number of people that can do computer programming is very small. Do you need a college degree to be a programming? The answer is no. But if you want to be employed as a computer programmer, almost all companies will only hire you if you graduated with a college degree. Colleges use SAT and ACT scores for admission applications, but these tests do not indicate if there is an aptitude for computer programming. Well, how do you test the waters without investing in high tuition costs? There is a course that is available. Stanford University has a free version of a popular intro to an online learning coding course. It is being offered for the second time this spring. When Stanford University computer science faculty members Chris Pyich and Mehran Sahami were unable to teach in person due to shelter-in-place orders, they were compelled to reimagine one of Stanford's most popular courses for a broader online audience. They called the new course Code in Place. And in 1 month, it enabled over 10,000 students in 120 countries to learn computer programming from 900 volunteer teachers, likely the most teachers who have ever taught in a single class. The Code in Place community was incredibly warm and supportive. The students and volunteer section leaders were very engaged and really encouraged each other to succeed, said Sahami, who is the James and Eleanor Chesbro Professor in the School of Engineering and Professor of Computer Science. Just reading the online discussions brought a smile to my face every day. Being part of it was an amazingly positive experience. Pyich and Sahami built Code in Place off the first half of Computer Science 106A, Programming Methodology, which is one of the most popular courses at Stanford and teaches the fundamentals of computer programming through the widely used Python programming language. To offer these lessons online, they created a new kind of virtual classroom experience focused on human-centered learning. It was exciting to be part of such a new model for online learning, said Pyich, who is an assistant professor of computer science. In Code, in Place, we made thousands of robust learning communities learn sections modeled after the very best part of course CS106A. It just felt like a beautiful vision for how online learning could be truly human. We reimagined who gets to play the role of teacher, and it worked. In a paper detailing Code in Place, which was published March 3rd as part of the 52nd ACM Technical Symposium on Computer Science and Education, Pyich and Sahami and their co-authors described this as a model built around a community that stresses learning for all, the importance of kindness and peer support. The volunteer teachers who acted as section leaders and led interactive weekly sections with up to 10 students were crucial to delivering on those promises, says Pyich and Sahami. If I am mispronouncing their names, I do apologize. Most of the section leaders were not professional teachers, but programmers in the industry or advanced university students, said Pyich. They were learning the art form of teaching, and they were inspiring to their students. Now the team, with Julie Zelensky, senior lecturer in computer science, joining as an instructor, is looking to repeat their success. cold in place will run again from April 19th through May to 28th. I love getting to interact with and have an impact on people in far-flung locales, said an instructor who led a cold in place section last spring and planned to do it again this year. It makes the world feel smaller and more connected and shows how much we have in common. Applications for students will be open from April 2nd to April 8th. If you're interested, go on to the Stanford University site to get more information. The course is for people from any discipline and requires with no previous programming knowledge. It consists of weekly lecture videos, a 50-minute interactive section led by a teacher volunteer, and four assignments. The instructional team also encourages online discussion beyond assigned sections to take advantage of the large, diverse international Cold in Place community. The success of Cold in Place shows that it can really be possible to scale education in a way that's effective and motivating by incorporating both the broad reach of technology and the compassion and humanity of people helping each other, said Sahami. So, if you're interested in programming, you can apply for this free course and find out if you have the aptitude and interest. We have many government regulations and regulations in government. The FCC has so far relied on data provided by internet service providers themselves to assess the competition and service available in each area of the United States. As part of its plan to update coverage maps in the United States, the Federal Communications Commission, in a break from tradition, is asking the average Americans to report which internet services are actually available where they live. In the past, the FCC has made these coverage maps with self-reported data from the ISPs themselves, an inherently compromising decision because internet service providers will naturally want to paint the rosiest picture possible. Since the FCC uses these maps as evidence for proposed regulation, it can seriously hinder the FCC's ability to make sure there's actual competition in the marketplace and that the internet is being responsibly distributed. For instance, a map might show that you have 11 broadband providers when you actually only have one or two real options. The Federal Communications Commission is inviting you, the public, to describe your broadband experience in terms of the choices available to you and your location, the speeds of your experience in real-life use, and your thoughts as to the quality of service of your ISP. The FCC, however, is using a general complaint form for information collection. It doesn't ask any specific questions about broadband at all. By the way, this form, I'll give you the words for it that you can do a search on. Broadband, data, collection, consumer, information, FCC.gov. It's not just a question of knowing what's really available to U.S. consumers. A bipartisan group of senators recently suggested that the FCC urgently needs to redefine what it considers acceptable speeds from broadband providers. The FCC defines high-speed broadband as a download speed of up to 25 megabits per second and upload speed of 3 megabits per second. The current 25.3 definition has been unchanged for 6 years and doesn't even meet Zoom's recommendation for a single connection. If the FCC is truly sincere that they want the average American to report on what internet service providers are available, the area of coverage, and the average download and upload speed, you don't use a complaint form to collect the information. You notify the mainstream media with a notice. This collection of data is under the radar, and they will not get meaningful response. It's almost like saying that the FCC did not receive meaningful feedback, and they will just let the regulated regulate themselves. A sophisticated hacking campaign was the work of Western government operatives. A sophisticated hacking campaign that was previously witnessed targeting security flaws in Android, Windows, and iOS devices is actually the work of Western government operatives conducting a counterterrorism operation, according to a new report from MIT Technology Review. The campaign in question, which has garnered more and more attention from media outlets over the last few weeks, was first reported in January by Google's threat research team, Project Zero. At the time, all that was publicly known was that someone had been up to some very tricky business, a highly sophisticated group, likely staffed by teams of experts, was responsible for targeting numerous zero-day vulnerabilities. There was a grand total of 11 in various prominent operating systems. This hacking campaign, which ended up going on for about 9 months, used the so-called watering hole method, in which a threat actor injects malicious code into a website to effectively booby-trap its visitors to the site that will subsequently become infected with malware, which allows the hacker to target and escalate compromise of specific targets. From all of these descriptors, signs naturally pointed to the involvement of some sort of high-level nation-state hackers, probably the ones wearing the black hats, or at least we thought, though few would have guessed that the culprits were, in fact, our friends. Nevertheless, that would appear to be the case. It is unclear what government is actually responsible for the attacks, who its targets were, or what the so-called counterterrorism operation related to all of this entailed. MIT has not divulged how they came into this information. One thing is certain. Google's discovery and subsequent public disclosure of the exploits, as well as the company's decision to patch the vulnerabilities, has apparently derailed whatever government operation was occurring. MIT writes that by going public, the tech company effectively shut down a live counterterrorism cyber mission, also adding that it is not clear whether Google gave advance notice to government officials that they would be publicizing and shutting it down. This has apparently caused internal division at Google and raised questions inside the intelligence communities of the United States and its allies. There's a whole lot of questions here. Obviously, first off, what government was doing this that has not been identified? What was the terror threat that they were investigating? Which websites were used in the pursuit of said terrorists? Given the sensitive political nature of these kinds of operations, it's unlikely that we're ever going to find out and get any answers to those questions, well, at least not right now. Can you imagine having these Western government friends that you will trust to watch your back while sharing the foxhole or trench in time of war? But let's not be holier than thou. We have done the same thing and spied on our Western government friends. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Self-Sufficient at Tech for Work.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time we get down to business. It's time we start talking about computers and technology in the workplace. The pandemic has brought us something that I don't know that we were really expecting. I know that we all went home and we were thinking that, yes, we're going to be in a different place, but it'll be just fine. Nothing will change. And the answer to that, or the response to that, is no, a lot of things have changed. I will tell you, as far as technology goes, you and I, all of us, we have become more self-sufficient for technical support. We have become so much better at determining what the problems are with our computers, what we need to do to resolve those problems, and move forward. This is something that we, in the office, we got lazy on this. If we had a computer problem, what did we do? What did you do? I'll tell you what I did. Even though I am a nerd, I fully admit I am 100% nerd, and I could go through and I could figure out a lot of these different things. There is nothing wrong with the fact that I dropped off my laptop a couple of times at the IT desk. And I said, here, this is what it's having a problem with. It's doing this, it's doing that, it's doing this, it's doing that. And I'm going to go to lunch. Enjoy. Have fun. It was more detailed than that. And they asked questions and, we communicated. And I also gave them my a cell phone number so they could reach out to me if they had questions. And, you know, and I did that voluntarily. I wanted to make sure it was ready when I returned from lunch. But I did that before we did all of this. And let's all go work from home. But what happened just recently was an issue where I was having a problem with a particular piece of software. And I called up the IT folks and I was put on hold. And I was sitting on hold. And I could have, and we frequently do this. We go, okay, this is somebody else's problem. I'm going to just leave it to them. I'm just going to wait on hold, listening to the girl from Ipanema or some other crazy, easy listening tune that they've got. Please hold. Your call is very important to us. We'll be with you just as soon as humanly possible. All right. So, you know what? I was sitting there on hold and I said, wait a second. You know what? I'm a nerd. I need to just sit here and I need to figure this out while I'm waiting for them. Maybe I can come across the solution. And I was there and I spoke to someone and they put me on hold and I kept on troubleshooting on my own. And then they came back and, you know, put me on hold again and I troubleshot some more and then I solved the problem. Here's the thing. I know that a lot of us are doing this. My wife is doing this. My wife has turned into her own little tech support, just fiefdom. She's actually helping out a number of people that she works with. If they have problems, they're starting to reach out to her, which is great. I love that. It's something that's stretching her mind. It's enabling her. And, you know, is she talking to a whole lot of people? And is she doing full-time tech support? No, but, you know, somebody might call up and say, hey, you know, can you help me with this? Sure, I think you might try this. And this is something we're all starting to do. I've talked to a number of people that are, you know, they're learning to become more self-sufficient for technical support. We have to. We're sitting in our homes. We are anywhere from 5, 10, 15, 20, and maybe an hour away from the nearest IT tech support person for our company. So we start to take on some of these things. This is actually making us better. This is improving us, not just for the company, not just for our long-term benefit at our own company, but on our job resume. What's one of the challenges that you've faced with information technology that you overcame? Well, hey, I solved this problem or that problem. Hey, that shows that you have the ability to analyze things and move forward. We all know that there are stories that we all have about how we were better than the IT nerd. You know, and that's okay. That's fine, because nerds are not perfect. They're not all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful. That's reserved for one guy. One guy, and we all know who that is. So, you know, this is okay. This is perfectly fine, and I'm enjoying hearing these stories from people, and you know, people that say that, hey, I've learned so much about technology, having to do it for myself. I want to challenge you. If you have not been self-sufficient with tech support, if you have not been doing it on your own, if you haven't been sorting out the problems with your printer or your Ethernet connection, your Wi-Fi at home, whatever it is, you know, that monitor hookup, you want to get it all just set up right. If you haven't been doing this on your own, I want to challenge you to move forward and do that. Find ways to make your technological life better and easier and empower yourself to learn more. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. It is World Backup Day and is celebrated just one day before April Fool's Day. That does not mean we back up our data once a year. We should be doing regular backups every day. History of World Backup Day was earlier observed as World Backup Month and was founded by Maxtor, a hard disk drive company. There is the 3-2-1 rule for backup. The venerable 3-2-1 rule for backing up data remains a tried-and-true method of ensuring the integrity of copied data that is essential to disaster recovery efforts. But it has to be done properly. As the number of places where we store data increases, the basic concept of what is referred to as 3-2-1 rule often gets forgotten. This is a problem, because the 3-2-1 rule is easily one of the most fundamental concepts for designing data protection. It is important to understand why the rule was created and how it is currently being interpreted in an increasingly tapeless and media world. What is the 3-2-1 rule for backup? The 3-2-1 rule says there should be at least three copies of versions of the data stored on two different pieces of media, one of which is off-site. Let's take a look at each of these three elements and see what it addresses. Three copies or versions. Having at least three different versions of your data over different periods of time ensures that you can recover from accidents that affect multiple versions. Any good backup system will have many more than three copies. Two different media. You should not have both copies of your data on the same media. You can be storing it on your hard disk drive and cloud storage or another media. If the primary drive fails, the backup will fail as well. This is why you always have the backup on different media than the original. One backup offsite. The problem is that when you back up on one site and that site is lost, your backup copies, using an offsite backup ensures that if you do have a fire, you don't lose everything. Your backup copies, or at least one version of them, should be stored in a different physical location than where you are backing up. An air gap is a way of securing a copy of data by placing it on a machine or on a network that is physically separate from the data it is backing up. It literally means that there's a gap of air between the primary and the backup. This air gap accomplishes more than simple disaster recovery. It is also very useful for protecting against hackers. If all backups are accessible via the same computers that might be attacked, it is possible that a hacker could use a compromised server to attack your backup server. By separating the backup from the primary via an air gap, you make it much more difficult and harder for a hacker to pull that off. It's still not impossible, but just much more difficult. Everyone wants an air gap. The discussion these days is how to accomplish an air gap without using any media. Back in the days of tape backup, it was easy to provide an air gap. You made a backup copy of your data and you put it in a box. And then you handed it to the Iron Mountain driver, and instantly there was a gap of air between your primary and your backup. It was close to impossible for a hacker to attack both primary and the backup. That is not to say it was impossible, but it just made it harder. For hackers to attack your secondary copy, they needed to resort to a physical attack via social engineering. You might think that tape stored in an off-site storage facility would be impervious to a physical attack via social engineering, but that is definitely not the case. Most hackers don't resort to physical attacks because they are just too risky, so air-gapping backups greatly reduces the risk that they will be compromised. Faulty 3-2-1 implementations. Many things that pass for backup systems now do not pass even the most liberal interpretation of the 3-2-1 rule. A perfect example of this would be the various cloud-based services that store the backups on the same servers and the same storage facility that they are protecting, ignoring the 2 and the 1 in this important rule. For example, it is very common for customers using public cloud vendors to back up their systems by creating snapshots or images of the resources they are using. The images are typically stored in object storage in the same account that is running the primary systems. If hackers gain privileged access they could easily delete both the primary and or secondary copies of the data. The 3-2-1 rule still applies to the cloud. Keep a copy somewhere else in a different account in a different availability zone and just keep it somewhere else. The 3-2-1 rule is also ignored by a lot of people using hundreds of cloud services. Important backups are stored in a system that you may or may not be backing up. Consider other services like email providers or file sharing services where even the primary copy of your data is stored only in a third-party vendor platform. The backups in many of these services are simply additional copies of data in the same location. Be sure to ask your vendors how they will help you recover if your entire account was hacked by a third party. A purist would say that the only way to have a true air gap is to put backups on removable media, such as tape, and then physically separate them from the primary. Others acknowledge that many companies have moved on from tape onto solid-state or hard disk protection mechanism and might use it only for long-term storage if they use it at all. The question is how to make sure a hacker can't access the primary and the secondary via an electronic hack. The current best answer is to separate these two copies in as many ways as possible. Considering doing as many of the following as you can. Different storage, use different storage type than what you use for your primary storage. An attack designed for one will probably not work on another. Different environment. Use a backup system that isn't directly reachable via your LAN. That's another way to prevent compromised on-premise servers from attacking your backups. Different operating systems. Use a backup server or service that runs on an operating system other than the Windows operating system can go a long way. Most randomware attacks have been against Windows. Using different accounts. As much as possible, use completely different credentials in your backup and disaster recovery systems. That way, if an account is compromised, the credentials won't work to attack your backups. Immutable storage. Some cloud vendors offer immutable storage where backups sent there cannot be changed or deleted until the time you specified. Even you can't delete them. The 3-2-1 rule is a good rule that has served the data protection world well for a long time. Always ask how well you are complying with it, and it just may save your bacon one day. If you are using cloud storage for backup, ask the vendor what are their rules for backup in the service they are providing. Ask the vendor what are the procedures for data recovery. Ask the vendor if you can do selective recovery of data. And ask the vendor if the user can define the retention cycle of the data. World Backup Day is celebrated March 31st. So let's have a celebration, but remember to do regular backups.
What would you lose if you lost everything? Photos, documents, all irreplaceable. It can all go away in just a flash from a hack or a fire or a crash. Well, you think it won't happen to you until it does. And then there's nothing you can do.
You gotta back it up every day, and you gotta do it right
with Synology.
3-2-1-3 copies sent to formats with one copy offsite
with Synology.
You can use Synology to back it all up. Network attached storage anybody can love. Your own private cloud to sync and share, or back it all up. It's so easy, I swear. Send it to the cloud with Microsoft Azure, Amazon Cloud Drive, Dropbox, and more. Back it up daily.
Back it up weekly.
Back it up whenever.
It's automatic and easy.
Take a backup pledge,
and your data will be
so safe forever.
With Synology, back it up every day, and you gotta do it right.
With Synology.
3-2-1-3 copies in two formats with one copy off-site
with Synology.
Smartphone cameras today are extremely capable. Whether or not you believe that smartphones are indeed viable for serious photography, it's a universal fact that having a good smartphone with a built-in good camera allows you to take more timely pictures. This applies equally to just a casual photographer who wants to take better than average photos. Even though I myself prefer to use a regular camera, and which I do quite often, I must admit that my smartphone is an adjunct to my gear, especially when I don't feel like carrying a digital camera in my pocket. Photography with smartphones have both advantages and disadvantages. Of course, smartphones are very portable and basically in everyone's pockets, wherever they go. Having a capable camera everywhere you go definitely gives you a better chance of taking better photos during your daily routines. Smartphone cameras are, of course, still has a lot of limitations. For one, the camera's sensor size on smartphones remain to be their biggest limitations. No matter how many megapixels the camera has, the sensor size limits the size and quality of the images that you can produce. However, for most people, especially for those only taking photos for social media, the image quality is more than adequate. At the end of the day, it's the user's preference and the actual use of the device that draws a line. Smartphones, especially those released in the past couple of years, do require a significantly different technical workflow because of their obvious limitations. A basic tip to maximize your image output using a smartphone is to really know the capabilities of each camera lens and which scenarios or the type of pictures you're taking it's best suited for. Each multi-camera smartphone has a more superior main camera that definitely has better resolution than the others. For most instances, your main camera will be the best one to use because of those reasons. The main camera is also, most of the time, the most capable in low-light situations. The usual secondary camera lens is one with ultra-wide angle for extended reach in tight places, and the trade-off, however, is that usually this camera has half the resolution of the main camera sensor. For quick wide-angle images, it's best to use the wide-angle camera, but if you have a bit of time to tinker with it and it doesn't involve catching a moving subject, there's a workaround with it, with the main camera, to produce bigger and better quality images. Being able to expose properly is, of course, the utmost importance. Smartphone camera sensors are one of the smallest sensors in the industry. There will always be limitations imposed by the actual physical size. Compared to cameras with bigger sensors, smartphone cameras' images have a narrow window of adjustments in terms of exposure, even those with raw image formats. Whether you're an advanced user who knows how to use manual mode or a beginner who uses purely automatic, there is a way for you to control your exposure. Even in automatic mode, most smartphones have the option of tweaking the shot's brightness by tapping on a particular point and dragging the icon up or down to adjust exposure. Being able to capture with your intended brightness goes a long way in keeping your photos in the best quality that they can be, and this applies even more in smaller sensor smartphones. Zooming in for a picture on most smartphones is digital zooming. It is not optical zooming. This means that when you zoom in with your smartphone, you're actually just cropping the image. Cropping the image means that you're ending up with a small image that gets exponentially smaller the further in you zoom. There's still a sensible degree of zooming in or cropping that you can do that will still give you a fairly, well, reasonable image. However, given the fact that you can very easily crop more precisely afterwards with even the most basic editing applications, it makes more sense to just capture the image and crop it later on. If you can avoid zooming in and instead physically move closer, in other words, taking into account the differences in compression and distortion to your subject, you'll end up with a higher resolution image in the end. Sometimes it's also beneficial to do the math when choosing which camera lens to use. Some phones have a really high resolution main camera and a second camera that zoom in but only has a much lower sensor. Sometimes it makes more sense to zoom in or crop the output of the main camera lens instead of using the inferior zoomed-in camera lens. A huge mistake would be to think that those smartphones with a 12-megapixel telephoto camera lens that do up to 30 to 100 times zoom would actually produce quality images. because, as previously stated, the 100 times zoom only means cropping the image into an exponentially smaller size. If you really want to take photos of distant subjects, a viable option is to use the external lens. There are a lot on the market, but be meticulous in choosing one with a really good glass lens quality. Another comment I want to make is that it's wiser to use a main lens camera in panorama mode, if it's available, to capture a wider angle of view than to take a simple snapshot with a wide-angle lens. For example, if the wide-angle lens is only about 8 to 12 megapixels, it is ultimately limited to that. However, if you shoot with your 24 and above megapixel main camera lens and shoot panoramic pictures to capture a scene without a moving subject, you'll end up with a bigger base image with even higher resolution. The downside of this, of course, is that this cannot be done in manual mode and you will not be able to produce raw files with this. But if you're fully content with the JPEG images that your camera phone can produce with this, then you shouldn't have any problem doing this. Most smartphone cameras nowadays have very capable automated modes backed by artificial intelligence technology. These do really well in shooting almost anything in the abundance of light. However, in low light situations, these automated modes can be quite limited. Automatic modes and night modes usually find a balance between increasing the ISO and slowing down the exposure, but they will only do so to an extent that wouldn't get blurred by camera shake. The camera usually doesn't know if it's on a tripod either. So instead of using automatic or night mode to shoot scenes in low light, well, try using manual mode. Put your phone on a tripod or anything that can keep it still for a few seconds and shoot long exposures instead, or at least slow shutter. That way, you can manually set your camera to be at the lowest possible ISO and do a long exposure than what auto mode would do. This will always produce better images. No matter how high the ISO is that the camera can go, image quality is bound to go down at a certain point. So no matter what is your level of expertise, a smartphone camera and knowing how to maximize its usage will always be handy for moments when your main gear isn't with you and you get that creative itch. I have many digital cameras that I use, and for portability, coming close to it that meets my portability requirements has been the Sony RX100. And it takes great pictures, but when I'm not carrying it with me, I'll go back and use the smartphone. Presenting Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, Spring Cleaning.
When people could only get winter heat by burning logs or coal or oil, the soot and ash and smell were big reasons to welcome spring. Better weather made it okay to open the house up again, to air it out. And it made sense to do other kinds of tidying up and freshening up at the same time. Spring cleaning is still with us, but nowadays, well, the priorities have shifted. Even if you just want to consider spring cleaning for tech, the pandemic has wrecked that being limited to only the usual measures. But let's start with things that don't change, like dust. If you still use a system unit PC with a case that's on the floor, dust can be complicated. We hate to think of those big metal cases as dust bunny warrens, but it's true. Dust can choke ventilation holes and filters, choking off cooling, meaning more heat buildup inside, meaning shorter life expectancy for most of the components on most of the boards. Start with a vacuum cleaner, but don't put it away. Also, keep the crevice and brush attachments handy. Slide out any filters and vacuum what you can see. Vacuum what you can. See if daubing them with a wet paper towel will clear them a little more, and then vacuum again. And when that dries in a minute or two, vacuum again. Just keep repeating that till it's clear. You can blow through it and nothing blows out. Put all the suction you can on anything that lets air through, screens or perforations or vents. Power down and open the case up and get in there. Then, when you think you got it all, you know, grab a blower. The Ryobi bench blower is a favorite here. Blow through the case fans from outside. They're going to whoosh at you. It's really kind of fun because dust will raise another cloud. That cloud of dust will, wow, it will impress you so much on how much dust really sneaks its way into a system unit since last spring. Oh, also, blow down edgewise into the fans on the graphics card. Try blowing out between the slot cards, and if you can, try to put some blow behind the motherboard. Oh, don't forget to blow between the fins on any heat sinks. Remember all that vacuuming you just did? Is everything all dusty again? That's why it's smart to keep the vacuum on standby. Clogged breathing passages are as tough on computers as they are on you. And just a guess, now isn't a good time to have to replace that PC. Follow that same approach with monitors. Go for the vents. Clean them out. Vacuum. Blow. You'll get it. Same thing with printers. Same thing with external drives. Well, there's still a pandemic. Stay sensitive to the surfaces you tend to touch. Mice, trackballs, notebooks, tablets, keyboards, headsets, because contact contagion can ride on those things. If you use a notebook, look for air vents and unplug anything plugged into any of the USB or other connectors. Vacuum, then blow, then vacuum again. It's a rhythm by now, isn't it? If you use a mouse or trackball, look for lint around the optics and the rollers. Use a pin or a needle to get the dust out from under clickable surfaces. Keyboards that are peripherals may have removable caps. With removable caps, step one is always, always, always to take a picture so you can precisely restore their layout. Was the asterisk to the left of the forward slash or to the right? Are there two of each of those, one on the main keyboard and another near the number pad? If you don't have a photographic memory, you'll be happy to have a photograph to jog your memory. With the keyboard unplugged, and if it's cordless, turned off, remove those keycaps. Gently, very gently. Blow and vacuum the keyboard bed. Use a quat wipe. Quat is short for quaternary ammonium wipe, but it's easier than that. Disinfecting wipes like Mr. Clean wipes or Clorox wipes or Lysol wipes, those are quat wipes. Use those to wipe that keyboard bed down. Then turn it over and tap it on the desktop to shake out anything that made its way inside. It's like crumbs from the end of a cereal box. While it's upside down, wipe the underside and the edges. Flip it back to right side up and blow it out one more time. Use more quat wipes to wipe down each keycap one at a time as you replace them. And keep popping out those quat wipes. Use them on your tablet case, not the screen. Same for your phone and your notebook. And use them on your earbuds every single day on your earbuds. Use alcohol wipes or screen cleaner wipes for your screens. And that means all your gear has just had its pathogen population rebooted back to zero, but you're far from done, because those aren't the only things you touch, and not the only way you track in contact contagion. Get some microfiber cloths and a good thorough disinfectant spray to use on your desk, on your keyboard tray, on and in your desk drawers, the pencil cups, your chair, the credenza, anything and everything that any part of you might ever touch. We're still not done. Use that disinfectant spray on the flooring before and after you, well, vacuum or mop, depending on what kind of flooring it is. Over at the vent register, unscrew that thing and take it off. Hit that register and every part of the ductwork you can reach with more of that disinfectant spray. You'll still need more spray and microfiber, or, depending on their size, quad wipes might work, to disinfect windowsills. Remember to also wipe down handles and latches and doorknobs and light switches. And since it's spring cleaning, change batteries everywhere. Smoke detectors, flashlights, clocks, those countless digital gizmos, get them all, because a new battery now costs you a lot less than a leaky battery later. Almost forgot, even if you're doing all this inside your own home, wear a fresh, new, disposable mask while you're working. Carefully dispose of it when you're done and wash your hands before you touch anything else. All that stuff you've blown up and might have breathed in, some of that can still carry contagion. Then, accept our congratulations for cleaning up your act and raising your shields against contagion. Next time, contact contagion and surface disinfection take center stage with the launch of a mobile service that comes to businesses with the category's fastest, most thorough, and most powerful UVC beaming robot called Move. That's Move with a U to put UV in the middle. For now, it's only available within half an hour of Solon, Ohio, a Cleveland suburb, but they'll start covering New York in less than a year. Be here as we tell you about Cleveland's new Move Crew HQ debut. Whatever pathogens are there when they come are goners when they go. And who doesn't love ray-casting robots?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meeting through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, April the 1st, 2021 at 7 p.m., and that's not an April Fool joke. Via Zoom virtual meeting, their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 2nd, 2021. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, April the 8th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 9th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org.
Brookdale Computer Users Group. Presentation of software for landing Perseverance on Mars. Thursday, April the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is bcug.com.
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any question for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key. And on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.